Earplay is made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. A series of contemporary plays for radio. Earplay. Earplay presents Custer by Robert Ingham. Ingham is an actor who has appeared in numerous stage productions in Chicago and Milwaukee, and is currently a resident actor with the Milwaukee Repertory Company. Custer is the product of years of research by the author into one of America's most intriguing legends. The play first appeared at the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center in Connecticut, and was later staged by the Milwaukee Repertory Company. Earplay commissioned Ingham to write an adaptation of his play for radio. Custer by Robert Ingham. George Armstrong Custer to his wife Elizabeth from Elizabethtown, Kentucky, 1871.
To my dear old standby, I have been rambling through the house. I've gone through my extensive and classic repertory on the organ, from Oh, Who Will Care for Mother Now to Put Me in My Little Bed, after an intermission to allow applause to die down and consuming nearly a peck of apples. I have responded to encores and gone through my list again, with variations, till even the wheezing old organ cried, "Let us have peace." And this is the last leave you get from your headquarters. Or next time you are to take your command with you, one long-haired cavalryman in serviceable condition. This place is called Elizabethtown, but that is a mistake. The town is here, but not Elizabeth.
Elizabeth Custer to her husband.
My darling boy, your magnificent letter of 42 pages sent me into the seventh heaven of bliss. The years have so changed me in some respects that, though I still enjoy the simple pleasures of a visit to my childhood home, still, when I am away from you, I no longer go into ecstasies over anything but your letters. How we have managed to preserve the romance after 9 years of marriage and all the vicissitudes. But though we've had our trials, you have the blessed faculty of looking always on the sunny side of things. Oh, dear Audie, you are the richest of men.
In a little rosewood casket, resting
you go and get them, sister. Will you mid-afternoon of the 25th of June, 1876, five companies of the 7th Regiment of United States Regular Cavalry, some 230 men, with their regimental commander, Lieutenant Colonel and Brevet Major General George Armstrong Custer, found themselves suddenly to be surrounded by several thousand hostile Sioux and Cheyenne warriors among the low hills and gullies east of the Little Bighorn River in southeastern Montana.
There were no survivors, and no one will ever know for sure how General Custer died or what the nature of his last stand was. The mystery of his passing haunts us all.
Meanwhile, on the bluffs, some 4 miles upstream, the rest of the regiment fought on, besieged for the better part of 2 days, and survived. Due mainly to the example and abilities of Captain and Brevet Colonel Frederick William Benteen.
After the Little Bighorn, General Custer's enemies charged that he had disobeyed his orders and attacked too soon, probably from a desire to reserve the glories of victory to himself and his command, that he had attacked without reconnaissance, dividing his command against an unknown enemy, and by so doing had brought about his own death, the destruction of his regiment, and the failure of the expedition of which he was a part.
Those who loved him sought to excuse his defeat and hide his failings by blaming other men. Of Captain Benteen, it was said that he could have fought his way through to General Custer and rescued him, but made no attempt to because he hated him and envied his renown. Having defended himself for 2 days against attack by Indians, Captain Benteen now found himself under attack from another quarter, an attack which persisted for the remainder of his life.
The last stand in this matter has yet to be made.
Moments come to every man, some situation in which he can achieve such fame that folks acclaim the very mention of his name. Now the circus played our town one day, 3 Bengal tigers got away. The manager, he looked straight at me. Yes, sir. Somebody's got to get those cats. Yes, sir. Somebody's got to go. Oh, yes, I know. Now the man that brings them back to me alive, a great hero is gonna be. Yes, sir. Wonderful chance for somebody. Yes, sir. Wonderful chance for somebody. Yes, sir. Wonderful chance for somebody. Somebody else, not me.
Captain Benteen?
There are people who will tell you that I am a sour man. A bitter man. One historical ass wrote, Captain Benteen, it would appear, was a man jealous of everyone and everything he met. Well, who am I to decline an appellation such as that? I mean, there is such magnificent symmetry in the stupidity of that statement that if George Armstrong Custer had been alive at the time, I would have sworn he wrote it. My God, but it seems to me that jealousy implies a wanting, that you want what someone has, or to be what he is. Well, I never wanted a goddamn thing, except a little peace, a sudden shortage of fools, a little better luck at fishing, maybe. I mean, it's enough to sour you. But good God, and little green apples, to hear these people talk, you'd think that I invented George Armstrong Custer just so I'd have something to be bitter about. Well, I suppose I spent too much of my time watching baseball games, and it spoiled me for the other parts of life. But I've yet to see an umpire throw his hands up in the air and scream, no comment. You call them as they throw them, or am I wrong? If a man has even one eye, and it is his misfortune to spend any time at all around the men of high reputation in this world, he'll spend so much time shaking his head saying, oh my God, that people will think he's contracted some rare form of palsy. Well, now, I didn't ask to be involved in any of this business. All I asked for was to be left alone to do my work. So, bitter? I don't know. I'm disgusted. But I'll survive.
Mrs. Custer?
I suppose If I were called upon to characterize myself, I'd have to say that I am a refused tomboy. Every little girl, I suppose, must at some point long to be a boy. But they can do so many more interesting things than a girl can do. Gallop about and throw green apples. Fight wars, win fame, and be listened to. But I examined myself, and I knew enough to suspect that my features, such as they were permanent. I would never be a boy, and it would be silly wasting my time wanting.
Tomorrow night, I just can't wait. Me and Kitty's got a date. Kitty alone, Kitty alone, Kitty alone. And I promenade and do-si-do, cheek to cheek and toe to toe. Kitty alone, Kitty alone, oh, Kitty alone at night.
If a young girl is very bright and hardworking, she will have the opportunity of delivering the valedictory address in the Female Academy. And that will be the last time she will ever hold a podium in her own life. So, I decided that since I was condemned to be female, I would be female indeed, and thus successful in the only way left open to me, as the wife of a successful man. I wrote out my specifications, determined my strategy, and set out to track down the elusive beast. And then I saw Artie, my dearest boy, then Captain George Armstrong Custer.
Gotta see her clap her hands when they play Sally Ann. Giddy along, giddy along, giddy along tonight. Take your money if you bet, never miss a single set. Giddy along, giddy along, giddy along tonight.
Quite fittingly, it was a reception at the Female Academy where I had been star pupil. I wish I could tell you what it looked like at that moment, but I can't. It was as if I had spent my whole life on a powder train and someone had set the match. Up went Libby Bacon in a blinding flash, her schoolgirl dignity tumbling end over end through the air.
Dance all night till break of day, don't care what the old folks say.
Be alone, be alone, be alone.
Remember blue? Oh, but that's an easy guess to my memory to make since it was wartime and they were all in blue. I remember cautioning myself that he was not of my social standing and his prospects must be looked to. I remember thinking that if he stayed where he was for 5 minutes, I would find a ladylike excuse to go over and talk to him. But that if, within the next 5 minutes, he came across the room and spoke to me, oh, I just might possibly fall in love.
She'd only marry me, then I'll have you.
Giddy along, giddy along, giddy along now.
Teach our kids to dance and play, driving all their food away.
Giddy along, giddy along, giddy along, giddy along, giddy along, giddy along now.
Well, he came across the room. I had been ambushed by Dan Cupid. I had fallen in love. The way a woman can fall in love with a town drunk and suffered herself to be beaten every night. He turned out to be everything I could have wished for. And so, I've had the best of all possible worlds. I am envied and looked at in the streets. I can make myself be listened to. I can rise above the din. And now, I can even be a tomboy if I like. Gallop and throw green apples.
After the war, I was wined and dined.
Artie?
Well, watered and dined, since we don't use alcohol. My wife is a Presbyterian, and I took the pledge to please her. But they loved me in the cities. Famous, influential men. What can we do for you, Custer? What can we do? You're the ideal hero. Custer, you're a trump. Oh. And I was a blacksmith's son. Some people were unhappy. They said I filled the regiment with my family and friends. My brother Tom, my brother-in-law Jim Calhoun, my brother Boston. I got him a civilian job at the fort. And others. I don't see what's wrong with that. I like the place where I am to be pleasant, lively. jokes. I like to be with people that I love, who love me.
3 years ago this very day, we went to Governor's Isle for to stand for an insta cannon in true military style. 17 American dollars each month we surely get for to carry a gun and banyet with the regimental step.
We had our choice of going to the army or to jail, or atop the Hudson River with a copper take to sail.
Oh, we puckered up our courage and with bravery we did go.
Oh, we cursed the day we went away with the regular army, oh. There was Sergeant John McCaffrey and Captain Donahue.
Oh, they make us march and go to Martin Gallant Company too.
Oh, the drums will roll upon my soul, this is the style we go. 40 miles a day on beans and hay, the regular army, oh.
I'm reminded of the way country people eat where I come from. They put bad beans, bad bread, bad bacon on one plate and cover it up with molasses. Now, there are damn few people in this world I want to love. Tolerate? A great many. Pass the time pleasantly with? A goodly number. Like? Some. Love? Damn few. Without molasses. This little drink I'm drinking is known to the trade as a toddy. Those of you of Southern sentiments or background will know it. I'm of Southern background, though not entirely of Southern sentiments. I joined the Union Army when the rebellion broke out in 61. No doubt because I was sick of hearing my father, my brothers, my cousins, and everyone I knew boasting and bragging how many no-good Yankees every one of them could whip. The confrontation, no doubt, taking place on the head of a pin. So I decided to test that proposition. I came home in my new blue lieutenant's uniform, and my daddy said, "I hope you die, and I hope the bullet that kills you is fired by one of your brothers or your cousins, by the blood that you have dishonored." Well, the next year, I was in charge of a battalion of Missouri cavalry for the Union, and my daddy was in charge of a blockade boat on the inland waters for the Confederacy. And my unit was introduced surreptitiously into his vicinity, and I captured my daddy. Yep, I did that. Captured him, captured the boat too. I sent my second to effect the capture so my daddy wouldn't know that I'd done it. For he surely would have broken a blood vessel if he'd known that I'd done it. But I did it.
I was often sorry that we could have no children. I would have loved a platoon of Libby Custers in miniature. But city people, sophisticated people, they don't seem to enjoy themselves as we did. Married life of friends.
Now what should we sing? I have it. Come sit by me, Libby. His manly whisker swept her cheek. She uttered no reply. How could she part her lips to speak while kissing on the sly?
There's such a sum of smacking kiss that creases could not buy.
The honeyed worth of one sweet kiss that's taken on the sly. Oh, this kissing on the sly, this kissing on the sly, this wooing, winning style of sinning, kissing on the sly. Kissing, kissing, kissing on the sly. Kissing, kissing, kissing on the sly.
Oh, my darling boy.
During the winter of 1868 and 9, 7 years before the Little Bighorn, while we were campaigning on the Washita River, Mrs. Benteen gave birth to a child at Fort Harker, and that child died. The campaign ended. We marched for Harker and me for her. But I had incurred the wrath of General Custer. And some halfway home, I was stopped by the adjutant, who, with a twinkle in his wild Irish eye, informed me that I would not be going on with the regiment to Fort Harker. Compliments of General Custer, my troop and I would be staying as garrison to Fort Dodge. With my wife at Fort Harker, sick and sick at heart, and he knowing it, General Custer knew it. He stuck me in the middle of nowhere at Fort Dodge. Oh, he was a benevolent deity, but woe be ye the unbeliever.
Let's be fair now, Captain. Can we be complete? May we just pause here in your headlong career and make the record full? What caused this act of cruelty? What did you do?
You know what I did.
I know what you did. Tell us.
You know what I did.
You wrote a letter to the editor mocking me.
I did not write a letter.
It appeared in the New York Times.
Without my name.
That's right, without your name. That's better yet. An anonymous letter to the New York Times mocking your commanding officer. What was I supposed to do? Thank you?
I wrote a friend.
Oh, come now, Captain. Read your letter.
I've read it.
Read it again. I write for publication, Captain, as you well know, and I know the difference between a piece that's meant to see light and a casual note to a friend. And that was a letter to the editor, if I ever saw one.
It was a letter to a friend.
An influential friend with connection to the New York Times. Oh, yes. I think you operate from ambushes, my friend, and I think you just got caught.
General, don't play with me.
Oh, no, I think I'll just let you
squirm. I think we're evading the issue, General. I think we're missing the mark. But if you want to gallop on, let's gallop on. Now say that having no other recourse but the public press that I did so do, consider a sequence of events. I come into the orderly tent one day, and there's Tom Custer and some others of the royal family clucking over a piece of newsprint. Who could have written such a thing, they say. And there I am in the New York Times, unsigned. Desperately attempting to conceal my authorship, I said, "Why, Tom, I wrote that letter. It's true, isn't it? You can see the stratagem in this.
I see a man caught in a lie."
"All right, you see what you want to see. It won't be the first time. And let's go on. What resulted from this letter? The famous horsewhip scene from your favorite comic opera. The boy general striding manfully about, smiting himself upon the calf of his boot with a riding whip. "Man," says he, "this letter had to be written by an officer of this command. And if I catch the blackguard," says he, smite, smite, "I shall horsewhip him in front of the whole command." "General," says I, "you'd better start whipping if you think you can. For I wrote that letter, and you know it. I told your brother Tom this afternoon."
This is so amusing.
Oh, it gets better. The boy, example, turns red. Smites himself spasmodically, does a series of impersonations of the various varieties of beached fish, recovers his best voice, and calls out to me, "You'll hear from me on this later, Captain Benteen." And I did hear. At Fort Dodge, as you have heard described. Now, say I did, as has been charged. Is that the proper way for an officer to handle it? With a horsewhip or a flunky? Deprive a woman of the comforts of her husband in her grief? Private punishments for public sins?
I think the captain forgets himself. What am I supposed to do? Defend myself against this? The bitter ramblings of a failed man? A malcontent? Whatever I may say or do, he'll win. For his ammunition is inexhaustible. He can always find another slur, another charge, another source of displeasure, for everything displeases him. The scores are in, Captain. The scores are in, and I've got the monument. And you can't stand that, can you? And that's what it's all about. I believe the word I heard was envy, Captain.
I believe the word I heard was different, General. I believe it was a question. What kind of a man are you to do the things you do? What kind of a commanding officer did you think you were? Shall we evade that question, too?
Successful in 60 cavalry charges during the Civil War, General Custer had 13 horses shot out from under him. His division captured more enemy battle flags and more cannon than any other outfit in the Civil War.
A letter to Libby Custer. I enclose 10 cents, all I can spare, for a monument to the noble General Custer. I am a schoolgirl, but can read the newspapers, and my heart was filled with pity when I read for Mother the other night the account in your paper of the awful slaughter done by the Indians on General Custer and his army. We girls admire brave men because, I suppose, and as Mother says, we are such cowards ourselves. I would have given the world to have had one look at the fearless General Custer. And then, he was so young, and as the papers say, so handsome. All the girls and women, I fancy, must feel as I do. For such heroes as General Custer are what we most admire. And then, you know, they are scarce. Leave it to the schoolgirls, and a monument will soon be raised to the gallant General Custer, for he was a man. Mrs. Custer?
This is my most prized possession, or most famous. This little desk, or writing table. It's not very handsome. It's pine. It's very plain. Farm furniture. But it was upon this desk that General Grant wrote out the surrender terms for Lee's army to end the Civil War at Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia in April of 1865. On this desk. And General Sheridan, the chief of cavalry, bought the desk and gave it to my husband. "Here, Custer," he said, "give this to your lovely wife. I know of no man who has done more than you to bring this about. That is the surrender of Lee's army. I know of no man who has done more to bring this about than you. And I'm told by General Sheridan that my husband went out, mounted his fine-blooded horse, and rode away laughing, the desk balanced upside down on top of his head."
Mrs. Custer, do you ever...
Constantly. Do I ever think he may not come back? Constantly. Constantly, constantly. I would go with him in his saddle pockets if he'd take me.
Thou art gone from my gaze like a beautiful dream, and I see thee in vain by the meadow and stream. Oft I breathe thy dear name to the wind floating by, but thy sweet voice is into my cry.
But you see, my dears, we cannot think of ourselves. We have a calling. We are a vital part of a great instrument that is cutting away the savagery and waste of this wild and beautiful land, which is God's work, you see. But if in the cold of the night you are inspired to weep, don't think that you are unique at all. We all do. It's an occupational illness of an officer's wife to weep alone.
In the stillness of night, when the star finally shines, my heart fondly holds a communion with thine. For I feel thou art near, and wherever I may be, let the spirit of love watches me.
And there, good, lovely work, Libby Custer. I set out to thrill and inspire you. And if I keep it up, I shall make us all sniffle and be silly. You must forgive me.
It's a way we have in the army. A way we have in the army. A way we have in the army to drive dull care away, to drive dull care away, to drive dull care away. It's a way we have in the army, a way we have in the army, a way we have in the army to drive dull care away.
But we think it is quite right, sir, on a regular Wednesday night, sir, to get most gloriously tight, sir.
to drive the pair away. To drive the pair away. To drive the pair away. It's the way we have in the army. A way we have in the army. A way we have in the army. To drive the pair away.
That's inspiring indeed, Mrs. Custer. Now, let's talk about the General Custer I knew. Let's talk about men who need rescuing and ride into the hands of God. Let's talk about why I felt moved to write letters after the Washita to whomever. Once upon a time, there was a major named Joel Elliott in the 7th Cavalry, and I believe that his death explains the death of General Custer. Now, Joel became disenchanted during the summer of 1867, as most of us did. When General Custer was court-martialed in the fall of 1867, Joel was called as a witness, ostensibly in Custer's defense. But whether through anger, ambition, or accident, Joel did not follow the Custer line in his testimony. And whether because of this or not, the court did not believe General Custer's defense, and he was convicted. I believe that this explains what followed. Now, in all the years that I've chewed over this indigestible concoction that my life became after I met George Armstrong Custer, I've never been able to be sure in my own mind whether I was working for a simple boy wonder, vainglorious and foolhardy and self-absorbed to an almost criminal extent, or whether I was working for a monster. A monster. General Custer came back to duty in the fall of 1868, just in time to lead us to the Washita. Just after we attacked there, a party of hostiles fled downstream, and in the general melee, Joel Elliott spotted them and took off in pursuit with some 19 men. The battle of the Washita was a typical Custer battle. No reconnaissance, divided command, just pitch in and pray to God. We attacked at dawn from four different directions while the band played Gary Owen until the spit froze in the instruments. We attacked what we thought was one encampment of manageable proportions. It was, in fact, the first of a series. Every angry Indian on the southern plains was camped within 10 miles of us, and Joel Elliott was riding straight into them with 19 men. Now, Custer was told. He was told twice. He did nothing. Our fight was pretty much over by that time. So Custer had lunch. He amused himself and his friends as best he could. It was decided that the captured pony herd would have to be slaughtered, so he went out there to take a personal hand, gave the captured Cheyenne maidens a display of his famous marksmanship, spent the afternoon shooting ponies with an occasional dog thrown in to add a yip to the course, while Joel Elliott and his 19 men died. And at the Battle of the Little Bighorn, when Custer disappeared downstream, we all thought, to a man, that he had abandoned us, just as he'd abandoned Joel Elliott at the Washita. We'd fallen for the image that he had done so much to create and foster, that Custer's luck would always hold. He might get you in trouble. He might get you killed. He might get himself into the most ridiculous scrapes and pickles. But he'd come out of it always smelling like a rose. I don't think I could have gotten through to him if I'd tried. But Custer's right in this, that if you just do and dare, sometimes in the confusion you can do the impossible. And I am haunted by that possibility. I cannot help but think that had it been another man, not Custer, I would have taken his failure to communicate to mean that he was in desperate trouble and needed looking out for, and I would have gone, let come with me. And who knows what might have happened. haunted by that possibility. When I would a damn sight rather be haunted in my old age by the advent of the seasons, the migrations of the birds. I still don't think I could have gotten through to him. I still don't know.
May I ask Captain Benteen a question?
Surely.
Why is it monstrous that Major Elliot was not rescued at the Washita, and not monstrous that you made no effort to rescue my husband at the Little Bighorn?
I believe I spoke to that.
I don't believe you did. Not to my satisfaction.
Major Elliot had 19 men. General Custer had 5 companies. You won't find a soldier on the plains who won't tell you 5 companies of cavalry, well handled, should be able to at least survive against any force the Indians could send against them. We did, for 2 days. So don't you harass me, little lady.
Oh.
You're a sweet, bright, gifted, lovely, blind, foolish, vindictive little woman, and I'm sorry you had nothing better to do than whistle Gary on with this worthless bastard. I would not cause you pain, but by God, you stay off my grave. I'm the best damn soldier you ever heard of. And if I didn't go get him, nobody could. And that's the last I want to hear from you or anybody else on that subject.
Captain Benteen.
You sit down, General. You haven't got a goddamn thing to say. You know, I wouldn't have said one word publicly after the Little Bighorn if she and her hyenas hadn't attacked me. You know, and I know, there's a lot that hasn't been said in deference to her grief, and a lot you can't explain. Joel Elliott being but one. Now, defend yourself as you can.
General Custer?
Captain Benteen mentions Gary Owen. And I think that should be explained. Gary Owen is, I suppose you might call it, the regimental fight song of the 7th Cavalry. It's an old Irish drinking song, actually. And I suppose you might find it some contradiction, my leading my men to battle to the tune of a drinking song, me being a teetotaler. But the words don't matter. It's what it sounds like that's important. It sounds like a cavalry charge, and that's why I chose it. If you consider that a cavalry charge begins from dead start to trot march, which is the verse, and then to gallop march, which is the chorus, with the last line breaking rhythm as a cavalry charge breaks rhythm at the end. Now listen.
Let Bacchus' sons be not dismayed, but join with me each jovial blade. Come booze and sing and lend your aid to help me in the chorus. And now, gallop. Instead of spa, we'll drink down ale. We'll pay the reckoning on the nail. No man for debt shall go to jail from Gary Owen in glory. Instead of spa, we'll drink down ale. We'll pay the reckoning on the nail. No man for debt shall go to jail from Gary Owen in glory.
Our hearts so stout have got us fame, for soon he's known from whence we came. Where'er we go, they dread the name
of Gary Owen in glory. Instead of spa, we'll drink down ale and pay the reckoning on the nail. No man for debt shall go to jail from Gary Owen in glory. Instead of spa, we'll drink down ale and pay the reckoning on the nail. No man for debt shall go to jail from Gary Owen in glory.
I am not going to sing you a song or make you weep. It's too easy to go down the garden path on a tune or a tear.
My name is Scott, Lieutenant Scott, and I served under Colonel Benteen. He was not what you would call a drinking man. Oh, he drank. I don't know anyone in that army who didn't, but when I knew him, when I was a young lieutenant in the 7th Cavalry, drink was no problem with him. He had what you might call a wooden leg or a hollow leg. But once or twice a year, or sometimes 3 times a year, he'd set in to drink, and he would drink himself into oblivion steadily for 3 or 4 days or a week until he could pass out. But he'd always go away from home when he drank so as not to inflict himself on his wife and his young son, Fred. that I never took it to heart, any of the things he said or did when he was drinking, for otherwise, he was the finest gentleman and the finest soldier I ever knew. He used to say, I set in to treat my men as soldiers and my friends. And they loved him for it. He'd say, Lieutenant, I want you to go so-and-so and do such-and-such, and you'll be looked out for. You'll be looked out for, and you knew you would be with Benteen. You'd be looked out for. So when he drank, we, the young officers of the 7th, we'd take turns. Then we'd look out for him. Colonel Benteen?
It's been my experience that the small pleasures in life are sweetest.
Sway the cot gently for baby asleep.
Children. I did dearly love to watch my children. Oh, the first time a little chap about this tall comes waddling up to you to volunteer your knee for his services, well, it's guaranteed to break your heart wide open. And though, with the exception of my son, young Fred, I had very little of my children. One poor thing I never saw at all, and the other since assumed. Still, I did dearly love and fully enjoy such time as I had with them. A little child is a lovely thing. And the love of a child is a pearl without price in my experience. Oh, this world could be such a lovely place, you know, if people would just do halfway right. And I wish to God I had the power not to take notice when it's not. But I can't. And this has led me to activities that are demeaning. Bitterness engenders, bitterness ensues. I must confess that I was not entirely candid when I said that I did not envy General Custer. I envied him his opportunities, and that he had so many he could squander them. I was not always content as captain of a company. Some days I did ache for a wider scope. And on those brief occasions during the war when I had my own command, I did enjoy it greatly. I never had so much fun in my life. And so I cannot help but miss it from time to time, especially when I see what other men do with it.
There were 28 bodies down in a ravine. E Troop, the Grey Horse Troop. Shot in the head, many of them. In the side of the head, in many cases. Or so the accounts suggest. They must have been taken from the flank, a sudden volley. That was the only explanation.
The 7th Cavalry was the finest regiment on the plains. We know this because Custer said so in his popular memoir.
You might get an argument from the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 8th, 9th, and 10th Cavalry.
You may wonder why we talk so much about the Washita River Battle in 1868. It was the only large-scale, close-range Indian battle General Custer ever fought. It came at the perfect time and made him famous once more.
But 69, nothing. 70, 71, 72, the regiment was in the South, enforcing reconstruction. 73, two little fights up on the Yellowstone, five companies engaged, mostly long range. 74, nothing. 75, nothing. 76, the Little Bighorn.
There were a lot of men at the Little Bighorn who'd never seen an angry Indian up close. What must they have thought when they saw where he had taken them? What might they have done to old Iron Ass?
My name is Wooden Leg, and I am a person. After we came in and lived on the reservation, some of the white came and got us all together, all of us who'd been there, and sat us down and said, "Don't worry," which always used to worry me a little when the white said something like that. But they said, "Don't worry, bygones," and so forth and so on. You see, since we had rubbed out all the white who were there, nobody was left to say how it happened. And the white worry when they don't know how it happened. So they came to us. Well, they asked me, and I began to tell them, and I think that I am making them, like, angry, for they jump up and down and stare at me and shake their heads and so forth and so on. So I sit down and I shut up. Then Two Moon gets up and tells them terrible lies. And the white, they write it all down and look happy. They love it. And they made him a big chief of all the people on the reservation. And he was no big thing when we were out in the world. And so the years go by and I become an old man. And everyone believes it happened the way Two Moon said. But this is what I think. Where I was, the gray horse Custers came down to the ravine, and we didn't kill any of them. Oh, a few, maybe. But when they saw how many we were, and that we were all around them, they began to fight each other. They shot each other, or shot themselves. And I was told that all the other Custers did that, too. They shot themselves, all of the Custers.
Where I was in the Bluffs fight, the Indian fire became so intense, we were being fired into from the front and rear, that some of the men couldn't stand it, and they'd slip out of the lines and go and hide among the pack mules and the horses, which you might call suicidal behavior. I had to go down and kick them out and put them back in the line. And so I walked the lines all through that day, if nothing else to shame them or inspire them into staying, to show them that they were being looked out for. I saved the day because I knew how to play poker with those Indians and keep them away, keep them from rushing us. And I did it for nothing. I remember there was a sergeant, Gutshot, who died all through the night, all through the day. But most of the wounded were quiet. They murmured or babbled only. I remember the smell of blood, that great quantity in that small space. 75 or 80 horses, shot and bleeding. 75 or 80 men. So much black powder smoke in the air, we looked like a minstrel show without white gloves. There were so many bullets in the air, you'd think that you could lean on them. My scalp ached for days from flinching. It was the only place I could afford to flinch, up under my hair where no one could see. Let me tell you what it feels like to be the only man standing in a hail of gunfire. I screwed up my best smile, stuck my meerschaum pipe into the middle of it, thought up a feeble joke or two, and walked those lines. Cut my thumb on a passing bullet. Another took the heel off my boot, and I kept walking. I did it because I had to. I had been left in a place where I never should have been, by a fool and his folly. I won that fight, and it could have been easy lost. There is not a man who survived that fight who does not to this day regard me with admiration amounting to awe. And I resent it. I goddamn well do, beg your pardon, ladies, but I do. I am filled with bitter resentment. You can put a tune to that and all clap hands.
We crave your condescension. We'll tell you what we know of marching in the Mulligan Guard from Sligo or below. Our captain's name was Hussey, a Tipperary man. He carried his sword like a Russian duke whenever he took command.
Forward, march!
We shouldered guns and marched away.
from Baxter Street. We march to Avenue A with drums and fife. How sweetly they did play as we marched, marched, marched in the Mulligan Park. We shouldered guns and marched away from Baxter Street. We marched to Avenue A with drums and fife. How sweetly they did play as we marched, marched, marched in the Mulligan Park.
If a man goes around thinking God is on his side and everything he does is right because it's he doing it, then there's a good chance that one day he'll find himself in a valley surrounded by 6,000 Indians and somebody will have to suffer with him. And I resent that. And I resent Custer. I don't know, and I no longer give a damn what happened to that worthless bastard. As far as I'm concerned, he started killing himself the day he was born. Just slow getting down to it.
General Custer?
I'm not sure I understand what's going on here, and I'm sure I don't like it. This is not a situation I expected to find myself in my wildest dreams. I'm excuse me. My wife is a Presbyterian, and I promised her not to swear. But let me tell you, in a good fight, there is a sheer joy to lay back your head and let the goddams roll. So, excuse me. God damn! To hell! Thank you. Now, where shall I start? I had an old dog who loved me once. She couldn't read the newspaper, so it must have been something about me. I'll tell you this, Captain. You're right. If I was wrong at the Little Bighorn, I was wrong all along. I did at the Little Bighorn what I had done to great success. And then you got to explain all the honors, all the success. Because I lost one fight in my life, Captain, that's all. And that's a pretty good average. The scores are in, you see. The scores are in, and I've got the monument. I've got the monument. And I think I'll leave it at that.
May I ask General Custer a question?
What? Yes, Libby, of course you may.
Was it that easy? I don't care about anything else, but did you trade me for a monument that easily? I had submerged my life in you. And you went away when I was 34 years old, and I lived to be 91 without you. Was it that easy? Did you trade me for a monument? Did you ride off and leave me without a second thought or a backward glance?
I never thought I'd have to. I never thought I'd have to make a choice. I never thought. I'm a simple man, I guess. I don't question much. Everything I ever did was what I was told to do, shown to do, taught to do by everything I saw around me. I was an American. I did what Americans do. And so did you. Be fair to me, so did you. And the thing that took me from you was the thing that brought me to you in the first place. Would you have married me if I was just a blacksmith's son? I suppose we let ourselves be trapped.
Yes. Do you know, after you left me, I made some little money writing books about my life with you, achieved some fame, some reputation on the lecture circuit, acquired a podium of my own in the only way I could have, as the widow of a famous man.
Do you remember the time in 67 when I left the regiment and traveled 150 miles just to see you?
Yes, I remember.
Oh, the victory parade in Washington after the war, when the schoolgirls put flowers on my horse.
Oh, yes.
I remember.
It's not bad, as traps go.
No. No, it's not.
And I think I'll leave it at that. Good night, Captain.
They made me a general when I retired, for the honor of it. And I wrote letters to a couple of friends who I knew would understand, and signed them so. Brevet Brigadier General F.W. Benteen. Underlined it a couple of times so they'd be sure to catch it, and laughed. But that's about all it's worth. This particular day, I'm roaming about the house trying to make up my mind between the baseball game and fishing. My agony is interrupted by a messenger. A battalion of young soldiers from Fort McPherson nearby are going to be out my way that day on a training exercise and want to do me the honor of a march and passing review. So, at the appointed hour, I bound down my terraces to stand at the side of the dusty road and watch those young aspirants to fame at $13 a month go marching past. And as I stand there, watching them go on down the road, it occurs to me that there is an emotion missing from the old soldier. There should be some sort of, God, I wish I was going with you. But I examined myself, and there was not. Wherever that dusty road might take them, I'd been down it. Enjoyed the trip, but I'd done it. And now, I'd rather go find a good baseball game.
Custer by Robert Ingham. Len Cariou played Colonel Benteen. Charles Kimbrough was heard as General Custer, and Patricia Elliott as Libby. Others in the cast were Don Scardino, Stephanie Katsourilis, Frederick Coffin, and Victor Garber. The play was directed by Daniel Freudenberger. Arthur Miller was the music director, and the music was researched by Dorothy Horstman. The banjo music was composed and performed by Eric Darling. Custer was produced by Carl Schmitz and engineered by Marv Nunn. It was recorded in New York by Earplay, the Radio Drama Production Center for Public Broadcasting.
Earplay is made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.